Iran arrests members of six teams affiliated with the Israeli spy agency Mossad. Thousands of demonstrators hitting the streets in Sao Paulo to demand punishment for supporters of ex-president Bolsonaro after the attack top institutions. The death toll from a single day of clashes between protesters and police in southern Peru rises to 17. This is the latest flare-up of violence after the ouster of President Castillo. Welcome. Iran's Minister of Intelligence saying it's identified and arrested members of six teams affiliated with the Israeli spy agency. The Mossad agents were plotting to assassinate an Iranian military official and conduct acts of sabotage in Iran. According to the Intelligence Ministry, a support network for the Mossad agents was also busted, and more than a dozen other members were arrested. The mastermind of the operation was based in a European country, and that Mossad was trying to use the recent rioting in Iran to carry out its operation. Tehran has said that the rioting was a plot by Israel and its Western allies. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has censured controversial French weekly Charlie Hebdo for publishing cartoons of the religious and political authority in Iran. Hezbollah has urged the French government to take firm measures to punish the perpetrators. And data for the cartoons triggered outrage in Iran. The country has witnessed protest rallies in different cities over the past days. Foreign Ministry also summoned the French ambassador to protest the caricatures while closing the cultural wing of the French embassy in Tehran. Charlie Hebdo's attack on the religious and political authority in Iran follows the magazine's sacrilege against the Prophet of Islam that fueled anger across the Muslim world. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a sit-in in solidarity with prisoners in Israeli jails. Resistance groups also holding workshops on prisoners and how to tackle the fierce attacks against inmates by the newly formed right-wing Israeli cabinet. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Families of prisoners and their advocates have staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails and detention centers. Tel Aviv practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, and Al-Quds. Among those apartheid policies is the bad treatment of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners are suffering tremendously inside Zionist jails, and we pray for their release. My son was only 17 when he was arrested and has been behind bars since 1992. He's a freedom fighter who fought for the liberation of Al-Quds and Palestine.
Palestinian prisoners who are held in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers are all denied basic human rights.
Prisoners' advocacy groups are calling on the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its grave violations against Palestinian prisoners.
Meanwhile, a workshop was held in the blockaded territory on how to tackle the dangers posed by right-wing Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir on Palestinian prisoners. The workshop was organized by Hamas's Wa'id Prisoners Society and the Islamic Jihad's Mujahid al-Quds Foundation for Prisoners. Attendees discussed ways of confronting threats by the extremist Israeli minister.
It's our duty to protect and fight for Palestinian prisoners amid the ongoing attempts by Ben-Gvir and the Zionist entity to pass a law that allows the execution of Palestinian prisoners, as well as the deportation of Palestinian prisoners. We are facing a big Zionist project, targeting not only the prisoners, but also all aspects of Palestinian existence.
For decades, the Israeli regime has violated all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention.
The issue of Palestinian prisoners is at the core of the Palestinian cause. They are held in Zionist jails because they fought for the freedom of Palestine and have kept the Palestinian cause alive. Palestinian prisoners have played a major role in fighting the Zionist project that aims to empty Palestine of its indigenous Palestinian population.
Palestinians are calling on the international community to break their silence and help Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Brazil's president has condemned as acts of terrorism the Sunday attacks on the presidential palace, the Congress, and the Supreme Court. Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva made a comment after a meeting with leaders of the House of Congress and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. They denounced what they call terrorist acts and coup mongering vandalism committed by the rioters. The raids were carried out by thousands of supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro. The aim was to overthrow President Lula's government a week after it took office. In response, hundreds of people have held a protest in Sao Paulo demanding punishment for the rioters.
Totally absurd. It's the worst moment in our history after the 1964 coup that established the dictatorship. I think everyone was appalled by the images we saw in the National Congress. The fight is now to support a government that was democratically elected, and we are not going to leave the streets.
The raids on Brazil's institutions are being compared with the storming of the U.S. Capitol in 2021 by supporters of former President Trump. But Brazil's communications minister says the attacks in Brasilia were more severe. Authorities have arrested at least 1,500 people and have vowed to bring the organizers to justice. Condemnations continue to pour in. One of the latest came from Venezuela, where the president called the rioters neo-Nazis and denounced their assault. Iran's royal ministry also expressed concerns about the developments in Brazil and called for respect for the rule of law. Now, we've asked podcaster and journalist Esha Krishnaswamy if she sees any similarity between the violence in Brazil and the 2021 riots in the U.S.
Superficially, yes. As in, superficially, they stormed the Congress, the Supreme Court of Brazil, and also the presidential palace, and there's a lot of aesthetics. But I see it as far more dangerous, just because we know that in what they did in Congress in 2021 was not likely to result in any change of power. But here we saw that the police and many members of the federal police actively aided the rioters. And also the governor of Brasilia, Mr. Rocha, was sacked recently because he participated in organizing these riots. So while superficially they look similar, I think this, even Lula agrees, the situation in Brazil is far more dangerous than anything that could have happened in the U.S.
At least 17 people, including two teenagers, have been killed in the latest round of clashes between anti-government protesters and the police in Peru. The toll makes Monday the deadliest single day of rallies since they began a month ago. The violence also left 68 people wounded. Clashes erupted in the southern city of Juliaca. Peru's Human Rights Office has urged police to abide by international standards in using force. The anti-government rallies resumed last week after a holiday lull and have so far left more than 36 people dead. Protesters are calling for early elections, the resignation of the new president, and the closure of the Congress. They also demand the release of ousted President Pedro Castillo. He was arrested after removal from office in December. More than 7,000 American nurses in New York have staged a strike in protest at harsh work conditions and staffing policies. Striking nurses rallied outside two hospitals in the Bronx and Manhattan. They waved signs in support of hiring more nurses and better pay. The walkouts forced health centers to move patients and scale back other services. The strikes came after authorities failed to reach an agreement with the nurses' representatives. The COVID pandemic has exacerbated nursing shortage in the U.S. Many nurses have left long-standing jobs for higher-paying short-term assignments. Now, a short time ago, we're joined by our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Colin Campbell, for a more detailed, a better picture of what the strike in nurses' working conditions are like.
Well, the strike was organized by the New York State Nurses Association. This is a group of nurses that have come together that advocate their own interests. And what nurses are saying is that they are stressed out, quite frankly. They are overworked and they are tired. So approximately 7,000 nurses went on strike in New York, and they called to the attention for some of the subpar conditions in which they've been forced to work in. What does that include? Well, you have nurses that are caring for several infants at a time, when usually it's regulated that when a baby is born, they are paired up with a nurse, meaning one-to-one, very specialized care. Well, now nurses are saying that they have to attend to 3 to 4 babies at a time. This could mean administering medication, making sure that they're calmed down, making sure their diapers are changed. And as you can imagine, These nurses are working overtime or working much more than they should be working. And they also say that because of the lack of nurses that some New York area hospitals have failed to hire, they are working even more when it comes to emergency room situations. And that could mean subpar care for patients. Instead of someone coming in and getting attentive care right away, they may be delayed. Or maybe a patient who's already been admitted may have delayed medication coming to them because that nurse is busy attending to someone else. So what they're saying is they need more nurses. They want hospitals in the area to hire more people and to make pay more competitive so more nurses will be attracted to those jobs and that their jobs, the nurses who are already there, their jobs will be a bit easier and they can do them with a bit more quality.
More news from the U.S. President Biden has visited the nation's southern border to get a first-hand account of refugees crisis that's snowballing by the hour. This as Biden just expanded a controversial Trump-era policy which allowed for more deportations of asylum seekers. Rami Mazzaro reports from Chicago.
United States President Joe Biden has visited the Mexican border for just the first time in his presidency. An estimated 8,000 asylum seekers cross the Texas border every day, with last year breaking records. Official data showed that the number of undocumented immigrant crossings at the southwest border reached 2.8 million people, breaking the annual record by more than 1 million. In yet another major expansion of a policy of Donald Trump, which the Democratic Party criticized for years, Biden announced the U.S. will immediately deport even more new arrivals. Biden has also drastically increased the number of deportations from the Trump era. The United States accepts fewer refugees per capita than almost any other Western nation, and the world's wealthiest country refuses to provide adequate resettlement and border services.
Let's not forget that the Biden administration still is running the very same for-profit internment camps on the southern border that are full of immigrants. When Trump was president, there was rightfully a lot of criticism of these policies. These are not just holding cells or whatever. These are basically internment camps where large numbers of immigrants, including families and children, are held.
Rarely discussed in the mainstream media is that U.S. foreign policy has played a major role in the Western Hemisphere's long-running refugee crisis. Instead, both the media and Biden's immigration policy give special priority to asylum seekers leaving socialist-inspired nations, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua.
Encouraging them to leave these countries that have socialist governments. And then, of course, the U.S. government says, look at these people fleeing so-called communism. It's exactly what the Biden administration's spokespeople have been saying. It's basically, you know, right-wing Cold War-style propaganda. And the reality is that these people are not fleeing. These people are going to the United States because the U.S. is telling them, we're going to give you visas.
2022 saw seemingly the entire West accused of racism due to their privileging of refugees from Ukraine over non-white asylum seekers. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Russia is slamming France and other Western states for the recent decisions to ramp up military support for Kiev, warning that such measures could deepen the sufferings of the Ukrainians. The Kremlin spokesman has stressed that Western arms deliveries cannot and will not change anything on the ground. Dmitry Peskov says that such moves would not deter his country from achieving its goals either. Last week, France and Germany announced they would send light combat vehicles, including tanks, to Kiev to help it fight Russia. Ukraine, that scored some battlefield gains in recent months, had asked its Western backers for heavier weaponry. Moscow has repeatedly warned that Western leaders are prolonging the conflict by providing weapons to Ukraine. The peace activist Daniel Kovalik says that U.S.-led NATO is pursuing its own hegemonic agenda at the expense of the Ukrainian people.
The U.S. and NATO don't care about Ukraine or the Ukrainian people. You know, people like Senator Lindsey Graham have said that the Ukrainians will fight the Russians to the last Ukrainian. And I think in the end, what really is the truth is that NATO will fight Russia to the last Ukrainian, that Ukraine's being sacrificed on the altar of U.S. hegemony. And I do think that the weapons the NATO is sending will not change the outcome of the war, but will extend the war and cause more suffering to the Ukrainians and Russians alike. I think, sadly, the war will continue into the summer of 2023, and I think the outcome will most likely be that Ukraine will be divided up at least into two parts, if not more, because I think, you know, the eastern part at least will end up as part of Russia. And I think Poland and or Hungary may take parts of the West. I think in the end, Ukraine will not exist as a country in the way that it has. And again, I think that could have been avoided through negotiations, but the West has not allowed it to happen. The problem is Zelensky is not in charge. He is a client of the United States, and the U.S. is calling the shots here.
Now, Russia working on extra measures to limit discounts on its oil in response to price caps imposed by the West on its energy. According to the Energy Ministry, it will apply monitoring procedures to implement the additional measures. Such discounts are traditionally there for international benchmarks such as Brent, but have widened amid Western sanctions on Moscow. Russia already reacted to the $60 ceiling imposed on its oil price by the West. President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree that prohibits the supply of crude and oil products to nations that abide by the European price cap. The order will take effect on February 1st and will stay effective for 5 months. Now, China has stopped issuing short-term visas to South Koreans in response to the country's imposition of travel restrictions on Chinese travelers over COVID concerns. Chinese embassy in Seoul said that restrictions by South Korea are discriminatory and would be readjusted after Seoul ends the measures. South Korean Foreign Ministry says the limitations are based on size and objective. It also says that they are communicating with Beijing on the issue through diplomatic channels. Seoul imposed the constraints last month. They include visa restrictions, testing requirements, and some flight limits. There has been international concern over the surge in COVID cases in China, but media in those countries saying that many parts of China are already past their peak of infections. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces shot dead 16-year-old Amer Ghazi Mahmoud Zaytun this year during a raid on Balata refugee camp outside Nablus in the northern occupied West Bank. Amer is the third Palestinian child killed by Israeli regime forces in 2023. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, in just a few days of the new year, the Zionist regime killed 4 Palestinians, including 3 children. The Zionist regime troops killed a 16-year-old boy in the Balata refugee camp in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus overnight. Defense for Children International, Palestine, identified the boy as Amer Ghazi Zeytun. He was shot with a bullet to the head. Recently, the Zionist regime occupation forces, accompanied by undercover Mistarivim agents, invaded the Shia refugee camp near the West Bank city of Beit Lahem to capture a camp resident. The group present themselves as Palestinians in order to capture, injure, or infiltrate groups of civilians. Camp residents confronted the troops, according to DCIP, and were shot at with live ammunition, rubber-coated steel bullets, and tear gas canisters. During the raid, the Zionist regime troops positioned themselves on the rooftops in order to place snipers there, according to a field investigation by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. 5 children gathered and threw stones at the Zionist regime troops under one rooftop. An eyewitness told PCHR, the Zionist regime troops opened fire on the children and another group of men, injuring 2 children who were taken to a nearby hospital. One of the injured was 15-year-old boy Adam Issam Ayad. He was shot with at least 1 bullet in the back of his shoulder. DCIP reported he later died of his wounds. The Israeli regime troops invaded Kfar Dan in the northern West Bank on January 2nd to demolish the homes of 2 Palestinians accused of killing an Israeli force in September. Ahmad Ayman Abed and Abdurrahman Hani Abed reportedly opened fire on the Zionist troops near Jenin that month using improvised Carlo rifles, killing Bar Falah, the deputy commander of a special reconnaissance unit in Nahal Brigade. Both men were killed by the Zionist regime army. The Zionist forces arrived in Kfar Dan to destroy the men's family homes as punishment for their relatives. Collective punishment of this kind is a war crime that the fabricated regime of Israel only commits against the families of Palestinians accused of harming Israelis, never against the families of Israelis who harm Palestinians. The Zionist regime troops forced the occupants of the 2 houses, as well as 10 other families, to vacate in preparation for the punitive demolition, according to PCHR. The Zionist regime forces completely destroyed one home, leaving 3 families, a total of 17 people, homeless. They destroyed 2 floors of the other house. Villagers gathered to confront the Zionist troops, throwing stones at them. Troops responded with live fire, tear gas, stun grenades, and rubber-coated steel bullets. 6 people were injured, including Fa'ad Mahmoud Abed, 17, who later died in hospital. According to a field investigation by DCIP, an Israeli sniper stationed on the 2nd floor of a house shot the boy in the abdomen, pelvis, and legs. Mahmoud Samer Hoshia, 22, from Al Yamun village, was also killed in the incursion. He was shot in the chest, according to PCHR. The fabricated regime of Israel appears bent on keeping up the same rate of killings in the first week of 2023 as a particularly violent 2022. Last year saw the highest number of Palestinians killed by Israeli regime forces and Zionist settlers in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds, since the Second Intifada nearly 2 decades ago. Violence and provocations against Palestinians have certainly not abated since Benjamin Netanyahu's new coalition government was sworn in last month. In a highly provocative act, the Zionist National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir of the supremacist Jewish Power Party stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound recently. The move drew rebukes from the Zionist closest allies, including the U.S. and Arab regimes, because it threatens a status quo that otherwise serves only the Zionist interest. Such incursions are associated with the so-called Temple Movement that promotes Jewish visits to Al-Aqsa in the occupied East Al-Quds as part of a gradual takeover process by Zionist settlers. The ultimate aim of the movement, openly declared by many of its adherents, is the destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock and their replacement with a Jewish temple, as they claim. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported at least two Palestinians were injured by Zionist regime occupation forces during the weekly anti-colonization protest in the village of Kfar Qaddoum in the West Bank province of Ghilya, local sources have said. Murad Showeiti, a local anti-occupation activist, told Wafa that Israeli regime occupation forces attacked the protesters with rubber-coated rounds and tear gas canisters, injuring two Palestinians by rubber-coated rounds and causing many cases of suffocation from gas inhalation among civilians, including children. The injured protesters were treated at the scene by local medics. For many years, villagers from Kfar Qaddoum and neighboring villages have been holding weekly protests every Friday against illegal Israeli settlement construction. More than 650,000 Israeli settlers live in Jewish-only settlements across the occupied Palestinian territories in violation of international law.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala Ahli Baytihi at-Tayyibin at-Tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are talking about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 192nd sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about the fact that the prophets and messengers كانوا أقواما مستضعفين. They were groups of people, they were belonging to the مستضعف. They belonged to the lower class of the people. They were humble, they were concerned with the difficulties and the problems of the people of the lower class. And we were trying to explain the fact that we want to kind of break this false idea, this materialistic thinking that is there in the people, that revolutions and social change are caused by people that have suffered, for example, some level of social trauma and political trauma, and they are the ones that can bring about social change. This is basically a materialistic way of thinking. It's a type of social determinism that some Marxists believe and some socialists adhere to. This is completely irrelevant to Islam. Islam doesn't believe in that. Islam believes that every human being has the capacity to have that revolutionary spirit as long as he understands the needs that are there in the society of a human being and what he needs to achieve.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, we talked about the fact that the prophets and messengers kanu aqwaman mustadhafin. They were groups that were belonging to the lower class of the people. We need to understand carefully what this means, very, very deeply, because we want to understand the logic of revolutionary thinking. To understand the logic of revolutionary thinking is very important for us to break and dismantle those wrong notions that are there in our minds that have materialistic understanding of revolutionary change. And of course, the prophets and messengers came for that. They came for revolutionary change. So we need to break and dismantle this materialistic infrastructure of thought in our minds. We need to bring about a new monotheistic way of thinking so that we can explain these revolutions and these changes. And monotheistic thinking tells us that a human being, wherever he is, and whatever class or position of the society that he has come from or has originated from, as long as he is bearing that human spirit and that connection with God, he can bring about the social change that is required in the society. If you notice the capitalists, they say, no, you have to be having capital. You have to have that high level of money and wealth to be able to create that change that is required in the society. While on the other hand, the socialists say that no, you have to come from the downtrodden and weaker position of the society to be able to, bring about the change that is needed in the society. Islam breaks all these barriers and says that every human being has that capacity. Every human being from whatever background they are in the material sense, have that capacity as long as they bear that revolutionary spirit. They carry with them that revolutionary thinking. They understand the position of a human being and where a human being can achieve. This insistence that we are giving in this particular point is to make us realize that all those who have that revolutionary thinking should have the right logical understanding that Islam has to offer and not to be confined by the thoughts and the theories of the Western or Eastern, scholarship.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, coming back to our discussion, we say that the prophets and messengers, they lived a humble life. This also needs to be clarified, that Islam doesn't say that the leader of the community or the society, needs to of Muslim society needs to completely leave all of those that lifestyle that he is in, and for example, live the lifestyle of the downtrodden people of the society. That he lived, for example, he should be laboring or doing hard work of that sort. For example, carrying things or doing that hard labor in the society. Not necessarily. Islam doesn't say that you need to be able to do that to be able to be the leader of a revolutionary thought. No. Islam just says one thing, and that is that to carry that spirit of revolutionarism and to be able to live a lifestyle, a humble lifestyle of lack of attachment to the world, a lifestyle where you understand the needs of the people and of the community, where you can maintain a revolutionary stance and can be together with the people in understanding their problems, and even be able to leave all of those material amenities to be able to serve the community. That is the requirement for revolutionary guidance in the community. But to say that, for example, to have that materialistic thinking, to say that, no, that the leader of the revolution has to, for example, be one of the workers of the community, the lower class workers of the community, let us say. And he has to be, for example, be able to be from the poorest families of the community. This is something of a materialistic thinking. Yes, a messenger could come from those places, could also come from another class of the society. This does not contradict with the revolutionary spirit and the humble attitude that is required for a messenger. This thinking is important so that we can clarify the revolutionary stance that is required by us as Muslims. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
Whenever there is a show of solidarity with Palestine or blasting the Zionist regime's attacks against Palestinians in any corner in the world, Western regimes try to label it as anti-Semitism. Multiple U.S. cities have adopted a definition of anti-Semitism that silences Palestinians and expands surveillance. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truth Out noted, in multiple cities across the U.S., the right-wing push for new laws to silence criticism of the Zionist regime for its human rights violations has reached a crescendo. As part of a growing international effort, the Zionist regime lobby groups have convinced local jurisdictions in several U.S. states to adopt the controversial and overbroad definition of anti-Semitism used by the International Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, which classifies virtually all expression in support of Palestinian rights as anti-Jewish. In California, the West Hollywood, Manhattan Beach, and Los Angeles City Councils each adopted the IHRA definition in the last 2 months. In Maryland, the Montgomery County Council did the same on November 2nd. The adoption of the IHRA definition comes amid recent high-profile incidents of anti-Semitism, namely Kanye West's incendiary comments about Jewish people and former President Trump hosting outspoken white nationalists Nick Fuentes at his Mar-a-Lago estate just a week after announcing his 2024 run. Indeed, those in Montgomery County who voiced support for that definition reference West's hateful comments as an example of why it needed to be enshrined as policy. However, while purporting to combat anti-Semitism, the IHRA definition is primarily designed to shield the fabricated regime of Israel, or the Zionist entity, from criticism and ultimately from efforts towards BDS, that is boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. 7 of the IHRA definition's 11 contemporary examples of anti-Semitism focus on the Zionist regime, conflating the Israeli regime with Judaism as a whole. Among them are applying double standards to the Zionist regime, or claiming that Israel is a racist endeavor. Israeli lobby groups are weaponizing the IHRA definition to punish and threaten constitutionally protected speech, in particular that of Palestinians, describing the Zionist regime's brutal military rule and denial of Palestinian freedom. Even the lead drafter of the IHRA definition, Kenneth Stern, has argued against its use in legislation or policy, stating that it serves as an attack on academic freedom and free speech. When adopted by municipalities, the IHRA definition expands the scope of policing by giving law enforcement yet another tool and pretends to surveil communities who speak out for Palestinian rights. For instance, when West Hollywood officials adopted the IHRA definition, they claimed that it serves as an important tool for law enforcement to identify, measure, monitor, and ultimately combat anti-Semitism, much like the post-9/11 counterterror surveillance programs that devastated Muslim, Arab, Black, and South Asian immigrant communities in the name of national security Will the IHRA definition measure public safety in terms of how many people that law enforcement can censor, surveil, and wrongfully criminalize? For decades, the fabricated regime of Israel, the Zionist entity, has faced increasing international condemnation for its racial discrimination and violent displacement of Palestinians. International watchdogs, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have both released reports accusing the Zionist regime of committing apartheid. Now, the IHRA definition is attempting to smear those criticisms themselves as racist. Black and brown activists challenging racist surveillance by the Los Angeles Police Department, LAPD, recognize the irony of this development. Akhil Gopal, a member of the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition based in Skid Row neighborhood of downtown Los Angeles, compares the logic of the IHRA definition to similar legislation that criminalizes predominantly black communities for criticizing police violence. The IHRA definition mirrors Blue Lives Matter bills, which treat law enforcement as a marginalized class. It is part of an effort to embed pro-Israel advocates within legal anti-discrimination, civil rights, and hate crime infrastructures as a supposedly marginalized identity in order to weaponize the language of hate and extremism against Palestinians. Gopal told Truth Out, "When the IHRA definition is adopted by municipalities, it encourages law enforcement to surveil communities for supposed infractions. As a coalition, we have been organizing to expose how surveillance is not just an invasion of privacy, but an inherent part of criminalization." According to research attained by Stop LAPD Spying, at least one academic paper funded by the Department of Homeland Security has already suggested using the IHRA definition as an indicator of extremism in its widely denounced federal surveillance program, Countering Violent Extremism. Community organizations, civil liberties groups, and policy experts have fiercely opposed CVE since it was launched, citing the ways in which the program criminalizes constitutionally protected speech, religious practices, and political activism. The adoption of the definition by DHS would be a dangerous expansion and continuation of the war on terror's devastating impact on Muslim and immigrant communities across the U.S. Selin Cassini, a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement, PYM, in Los Angeles, explains that she has worked with the Stopped LAPD Spying, Black Alliance for Just Immigration, Vigilant Love, and other community organizations to oppose CVE, which racially profile communities and deputizes mental health providers, teachers, and other service providers to report community members to law enforcement under false pretenses of extremism. If the IHRA definition were to be incorporated into CVE, we can expect an increase of reports accusing pro-Palestine speech and activism as extremists, she said. This is not only an attempt to intimidate our communities and allies from building power through local organizing, but to also restrain free speech, consequently diminishing the health of our communities. Palestine Legal, a civil rights organization dedicated to providing legal support The movement for Palestinian rights has recently discovered through public records requests that pro-Israel organizations have sent PYMs, flyers and materials to law enforcement, asking that Cassini's organization be put under police surveillance and shut down. The attempts to push the IHRA definition into law are just the latest example of the long-standing right-wing effort to redefine anti-Semitism as characterized primarily by criticism of the Zionist regime, rather than as an interconnected element of white supremacy and all forms of racial bigotry. Roughly half of the incidents of suppression Palestine legal response to each year include false accusations of anti-Semitism, totaling 1,017 incidents from 2014 to 2021. The adoption of the IHRA definition in multiple cities is not only dangerous, but also surprisingly regressive considering the broad array of institutions that have rejected it. Both Palestinian and Jewish human rights organizations, as well as major newspaper editorial boards, have opposed codifying the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism into law, including the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Palestine Legal, Jewish Voice for Peace, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post. Cassini and Gopal's organizations continue to resist the IHRA definition and hope community opposition will prevent it from continuing to spread across the U.S. and beyond.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith which has been narrated from Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Today we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith which has been narrated from Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. This beautiful hadith is about a very important topic, one of the principal and very vital Islamic virtues, and that is maintaining ties and relations with one's kin. As you know, it's an obligation to maintain ties with one's kins, with one's relatives, and it's considered a grave sin to cut off one's relation with them. This is something which has been mentioned in the Holy Quran. In the Holy Quran, we read the following: May it not be that if you were to wield authority, you would cause corruption in the land and cut off the ties of kinship. They are the ones whom Allah has cursed. أُولَٰئِكَ الَّذِينَ لَعَنَهُمُ اللَّهُ. So he made them deaf and blinded their sight. This is a stern warning, and it kind of alludes to the severity of breaking the ties with kin in the Holy Quran. And the Quran says that even if you were given power and you were to become the ruler of the entire world, this doesn't give you the right to cut off your ties with your relatives. In any case, in this beautiful hadith, the Imam alayhi salam, he alludes to one of the unfaithful and one of the very bad consequences of doing so. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "The sin that hastens one's death is cutting off ties with one's kin." Right? So if we break ties with one's kin, this can decrease our lifespan. It can hasten death. And conversely, if we maintain good relations with them, you know, it has a good effect on, you know, increasing our lifespan. In another similar tradition, Imam Ali alayhi salam also mentions another bad consequence and effect of cutting ties with one's relatives. He says, if they cut off ties with their kin, their wealth will be placed at the disposal of evil people. Meaning this person's wealth will end up in the hands of, you know, very bad people. You know, they will do bad things with his wealth. And the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he also mentions another effect of cutting ties with one's relatives. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Verily, angels do not go to visit a people if among them lives one who has cut ties."